Welcome to another episode of The Carmudgeon Show. I am Jason Camisa. That will introduce itself.
Is one Derek Tam hyphen Scott. This is part of the Haggerty Podcast Network. Did you say what this show is? You did just say what this show is.
No. I said it's a Carmudgeon Show. Yes. I didn't tell them what we're talking about. They might leave if they find out.
This is about some, I don't know, is that investigative journalism? Not performed by us, of course.
No, we just stole.
But consumed by us and then amplified, perhaps, or shared.
It turns out your insurance company might be getting a play-by-play of all the fucked up shit you do behind the wheel.
That's why you drive in a no-internet car.
Yeah, dial up. Dial up all the way.
Oh, fax, telefax, telex. And then we sort of go on a fairly long and in-depth discussion also about Dieselgate and some Ferdinand Piëch.
Corporate conscience, hookers blow. And,
yeah, that's true. There's there's brothels in this episode. It's very discordant. Spicy.
And discordant.
Discordant and spicy, just like me.
Oh, God. If you like this content and not that statement, please consider joining the Haggerty Drivers Club, which includes unlimited access to our evaluation tools, unlimited guaranteed flatbed tows for all of your classic cars, our award-winning magazine subscription, and plenty more. There's a link below. And we're going to go play our little music now. You know what I hate?
Tell us.
Everyone and everything. And that includes when I recommend a car to people and say, you should buy this car, and then have to immediately slam on the brakes, jack the e-brake, and make a U-turn and go the other way and say, do not buy this car.
Okay, what happened?
Oh, sometimes there's like, you know, engines blowing up like Shelby GT350s and stuff. But what happened in this particular case is two of the cars that I recommend to people the most enthusiastically, the Hyundai Veloster N and the
Civic, those are gone now.
Those are gone. And the Civic Type R, along with, I guess, to some lesser extent, the Integra Type S. And Civic Si have a slight issue, which is that the scumbag piece of shit executive assholes in charge of that company sell customers data about how they're driving to a company called LexisNexis, which is basically an information gathering company that keeps like all of your legal records and stuff like that, which your insurance company then has access to and can charge. You can drop you or charge you enormous premiums and whatnot.
So what's in it for the manufacturer?
Money.
Just selling data.
Selling data. Why don't you seem really upset about this?
Because I drive an old car. I drive exclusively old cars. Yeah. They do not have internet.
or if they do, it's dial-up. And
some of them have dial-up. Most of them have no internet at all.
Yeah. So what happened was a couple weeks ago, there were a bunch of class action lawsuits filed against General Motors. I think GM was specifically the first one because it was caught. I don't know if caught's the right word. Selling.
Discovered.
It was discovered that GM was selling driver information to LexisNexis. And this happened because Florida man.
Can we say more specifically what kind of driver information?
Quote, hard accelerations, I believe it was, hard braking events, time spent over 80 miles an hour. And
general adhesion to speed limit.
Yeah. And also like one of the articles that I read was somebody got their LexisNexis report and it was 380 pages and it detailed like 690 trips that this owner had taken in the car in his Chevy Bolt over a certain period of time. And all of this is bundled into OnStar. Like, you know, OnStar has connectivity abilities. And a lot of these cars have the ability to track what you do. The question becomes, are you ever giving consent to, mm-hmm. for that information to be used against you? And so, you know, there was a time where you could buy a dongle that would go into your OBD2 port.
I think you still can, right?
No. Yeah, I'm sure some insurance companies do. And then that will track what you do and send your sort of driving information to a car to an insurance company. And you could thus, as it was sold, get a discount. So the idea is the standard fee is $100 a month for your Nissan Altima. But if we find that you are not driving like a typical Nissan Altima driver.
Well, that shouldn't be hard at all, given how Nissan Altima drivers typically drive.
I wonder
what the premiums are of Nissan Altimas. Do you think they're just astronomical?
No, I think there are so many of them that that I think the average
Altima
drivers,
out.
Yeah, not. However, you know, you would think, okay, there's baseline and I can apply for a discount if I'm one of those people who don't.
Everybody thinks they're a better than average driver, but by definition, that can't be true because 50% of people have to be better and 50% of people have to be worse, but they overestimate their competence as operators.
You're really stuck in this Altima thing, aren't you?
No.
I'm kidding. I was fully expecting, there's no way that any Altima driver is better than a 10th percentile. No, you're totally right. But I mean,
everybody thinks they're going to get a discount because they're like, I'm a better driver than most people.
But do you think anyone would ever sign up for it if it was not just there as a potential discount, but they were like, hey, you go up, you go down.
Well, yes.
No one would fucking sign up for this shit. So, but that's one thing. That's an explicit thing. I'm buying a piece of equipment. I'm plugging into my car and I know that I'm participating in this. I think the gray area that these car companies have landed in is that even maybe though it had been disclosed in some sort of electronic boilerplate, I accept.
Yeah, but everybody always just scrolls past that shit and just accepts because, you know, who's going to read all that stuff? You did that every time, you would have starved to death because you wouldn't have been able to work or eat or do anything else.
I mean, my favorite part is when car companies put a, you must accept this thing screen, and then it times out after a certain amount of time and just, you never accept it and it just goes away. And the reason for that is that boilerplate language is not actually legally enforceable. Like there's a point at which a judge will say, no one is reading that, especially in a moving motor vehicle. Come on. Like no one's ever going to read it. It's meaningless. But a lot of these, people have, whether they realized it or not, signed up to have their.
My read was also that a lot of them did not even acknowledge, or there was no ever any request. They were kind of just doing it.
Well, the second part of that paragraph, if you're talking about the same article I am, was that the dealer was incentivized to get them to sign up for these services. It was, you know, OnStar extra stuff. And so here we have a situation where General Motors dealerships are incentivized to get people to sign up for this OnStar service that then reports all of their trip and driving information to a data aggregator who then sells it to insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was some guy got dropped and got turned down by 7 different insurance companies. And what the fuck is going on? One of those insurance companies said, hey, you might want to have your LexisNexis report run. And there it was. You drive like an asshole and therefore no one's insuring you. And right now, I think I want to say year over year, the average insurance premium, car insurance premium, has gone up by 20-something%.
Yeah, I've seen that nationwide. As well. A lot of people are complaining about this in various places. Identifying it and then sharing their stories with various people.
Imagine if your insurance company, I want you to imagine, I know technically there's a Hagerty logo right there, but let's just pretend you're not doing a podcast for an insurance company. Could you imagine if Hagerty knew how you drove?
I drive like an angel.
From hell? Like an actual hell's angel?
I am very
I ask that
offended.
Question because I'm ratting you out. I ask that question not as you, but I mean the sort of all of you. Like, seriously, imagine if your insurance company knew the shit you pulled. We're enthusiasts. We're not driving like.
That's why I just have this sensation of just calmness over the fact that I drive old cars.
Well, you're not exempt. Everyone's got a camera and a dash cam and a phone. I mean, the idea of privacy at this point is kind of scary. But all right, I think a reasonable expectation of privacy is that, all right, if I cut somebody off and brake check them and they have a dash cam, they could go to the police, right? And so I have some sort of expectation that if I do shitty things in public, unlike 15 years ago, I'm not going to get away with it anymore. I don't think it is a reasonable thing to assume that my car is ratting on me to my insurance company every time I get behind the fucking wheel. Mm-hmm. I
find that extremely disquieting.
Yeah. Disquieting?
Yes.
I don't think I've ever heard that word before.
We're gonna get a Jake dictionary definition of disquieting.
I mean, I believe you that it's a word. It's just, I thought you were gonna say disheartening.
No, disquieting is a better word.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
You sure about that?
Feelings of anxiety or worry.
So something that is disquieting, it unquiets you, meaning
inducing feelings of anxiety or worry.
Okay. Upsetting.
Yeah.
It's fucking really upsetting.
Yeah.
So, and then one step further, right? So Honda Acura. So there's a bunch of car companies that have just been sort of revealed to do this. General Motors, Honda Acura, Subaru.
Takes the delight out of buying a Blackwing, huh?
Mitsubishi, Kia.
So is the hard acceleration, like if you're doing a burnout, right? The car's not really accelerating very much. So like, is it coming from the accelerometers in the car? Like, does it know if you're doing a burnout? Because you could be, you know, if you properly manage the brake pedal during a burnout, then you're actually not accelerating very aggressively. Or is it like, you know, does it calculate the distance the front tires have gone versus the rear tires?
What do you think? If you were the person, the scumbag at one of these car companies thinking we can make another 5 cents a year off of each one of these cars to offset the whatever it cost them for cell service or, you know, to have connectivity in the car. If you were that scumbag, how would you program it? How would you define hard acceleration? But my favorite quote is the guy from Florida who's like, hard braking, my passengers aren't hitting their head on the dashboard. I'm with him. As long as no one's getting knocked unconscious, you're not fucking braking, doing anything dangerous.
I mean, there's also something completely arbitrary about what are the sensors in the car actually able to detect, right? It detects hard acceleration, hard braking, and it determines by default that those are dangerous activities. You know, what it can't detect is some jackass who's texting and driving 47 miles an hour on the highway, you know, and it counts that as perfectly.
Have you ever been to South Florida?
Yes.
So, okay, you've driven I-95.
Mm-hmm.
The one characteristic that it outweighs all of them of I-95 is you go from 80 to 0 to 80 to 0 to 80 to 0. I-95 just comes to screeching halts all the time. So I'm going to be given a demerit point for slowing down with traffic, for example, rather than
hitting someone
or driving on the fucking median because God forbid it's going to record as another hard stop. What stupidity is this?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's extremely reductionist, right? It's deciding, it's making a definition of dangerous driving based on somewhat arbitrary things which are not intrinsically dangerous.
So imagine I have a Honda Civic manual, right? Let's say a Civic base manual, which we discussed is available in a previous episode.
But not purchased by anyone.
Well, okay, but one of those people did. And they inadvertently signed up for, or maybe the dealer signed them up for some.
Before they took delivery of the new car because it gives them the incentive.
And they are a hypermiler. And they've studied physics. And they know that to get the best possible economy out of an internal combustion engine, you run it wide open at low revs. And then imagine the schmuck at Honda who thinks making 5 cents off of that person's information is like going to look at accelerator pedal position for hard acceleration. Here's somebody who is matted all the time at 1100 RPM in sixth gear because he knows that's the most efficient way of acceleration, who's going to lose his car insurance over this.
What? No, it's just going to go up by 50%.
Well, the one guy that they quoted was doubled.
Yes, yes.
So it went up by 100% after getting turned down by 7 other companies. I find this also unbelievably unacceptable until you get to the last part, which is that Hyundai Kia give you a driving score and Honda Acura give you a driver feedback score, which is like, this is how efficient you're driving. Like the first gen Nissan Leafs, you could grow like a leafy thing.
And then it would like, if you were too much of an asshole, then it would wither and die.
Exactly.
And then like it would turn.
It was a gamified way of like getting you to be, my e-golf gives, or your GTI and e-golf probably gave you an eco score, right?
The e-golf did. I don't remember if the GTI did.
Yeah. But either way,
I think I always turned it to oil temperature anyway.
Yeah. Well, why the fuck are you kidding about an eco score, right? I never look at that. But if I would find out right now that was ratted out via a cell cell phone in the car to my insurance company every time I got an EcoScore. Turns out the driver feedback score and the driving score from those cars are transmitted to LexisNexis. Mm-hmm. Or what's the other one? Vera. Blah, blah, blah. There's another company.
Yeah, it starts with VeraScan or something like
Vera
that.
Vera somebody. I am fucking appalled. So apparently GM just announced last week, so I don't know when this episode's going to air, but recently announced after this whole scandal broke that they would no longer send non-anonymized data to LexisNexis, but didn't rule out that they'd send it to somebody else. They're just going to say, you know, we won't send it to LexisNexis.
I mean, if it's going to be used for insurance, then it can't be anonymized. The Correct. Information is useless, because if it's anonymized, then you're just doing like this massive aggregation of, like, for example, this is Feet. How Google Maps will determine how many minutes it thinks it's going to take you to get somewhere by just... Hopefully it's anonymized data that it is looking at thousands of trips over that section of road and figuring out how long it takes people to do stuff. Mm-hmm. I think fundamentally humans, or most of us, I assume, don't really object to that type of tracking of our information, because it's sort of like just being fed into some algorithm to serve some purpose that is sort of at a scale that doesn't affect the individual. But in a case where your insurance premium is directly affected by it, yeah. Totally unacceptable.
Yeah, I'll use Waze. I use Waze. Waze uses real-time tracking of every one of its users mm-hmm. that feeds it in, and it'll help me save 3 minutes. I'm fine with that. But the idea that without my knowledge, this stupid gamified yeah. driver feedback score is actually going to be sent back to my insurance company based on who knows what stupid...
Yeah, I mean, it's completely arbitrary. Like we just talked yeah. about. It's just this information that it decides are proxies for safe operation. But, you know, is there some underlying study that says that, you know, hard acceleration events or hard braking events are intrinsically dangerous?
Probably not.
Especially standing on the brakes and getting an ABS when traffic screeches to a halt and it You're holds all, that when, against you.
Right, when the alternative is
to plow in the back of someone.
Which, depending
which
on
Which also does
driving.
Affect your insurance premium as well.
True.
In a different way.
Yeah. Unless you can prove they brake checked you with the, you know, with whatever systems are monitoring you at the time. I have a big problem with it for this because.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's completely unacceptable.
Right. The problem is that I've told people to go buy Honda Civic Type Rs. And now I have to say no. Like that Civic Type R is off of my buy list, as is every GM product until I find out exactly what they're transmitting, as is every Subaru, as is every Kia, I would love to have an IONIQ 5N. I haven't driven one yet. It's happening soon. Super excited about that. The answer is absolutely not. Not unless I can open some module, bludgeon the shit out of the SIM card and make it so that
just
it can't
wrap
talk.
The car in aluminum foil so it can't transmit. It looks super cool.
Can I put a colander on my head too?
You're turning into a conspiracy theorist. No, it's not a conspiracy.
I was going to say
there's actual data, but I mean, it's
this is scary shit.
Yeah, it's very scary. But fortunately, there aren't very many new cars that interest me.
But the audience, they're all driving new cars.
I know. Well, that sucks to...
You know. I mean, is this episode end? Go drive old cars without a license plate on them? So yeah. No one can track you?
I mean, kind of. I don't know. I guess I'm sort of jaded by the fact that just the litany of shitty things that corporations do to citizens at large, that nothing really surprises me anymore. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I know we work... Well, I work full-time for an insurance company and you are part of the insurance company podcast network. But if I found out that Hagerty used, you know, sort of non-anonymized data from my cars, I would leave. In a second, I would cancel my policy overnight.
And then the question becomes, like, if this becomes normalized and it's sort of commercialized as the only way that happens and you have no alternatives, then what are you to do?
Yeah, I think at this point we have alternatives because from what I've seen, it's only that handful of companies that we've... that have been identified that are doing this. Mm-hmm. I think it just needs to be outlawed immediately. And the fact that there are as many class action lawsuits as there are, I think is a
well, sign as we discussed, there's a, you know, a problem anytime the technology introduces new possibilities that were not previously considered by the law. I mean, the law necessarily is reactive because the law can't foresee every possible thing that could potentially happen and then regulate it. Mm-hmm. And so then you get into the roles of sort of consumers exerting their voices via watchdog groups or sort of consumer mm-hmm. advocacy groups. So, you know, I guess it's not too late. The point is to use this podcast as a platform to raise awareness while there's still the possibility for consumers to exert their rights and mm-hmm. sort of identify.
Well, I mean, sorry, right.
So
in
risk.
That, in that vein, the first thing, if you own one of these cars, go and make sure you've turned off.
Yeah, you can apparently turn it off in the GM one, which is, I guess, heartening. But I would absolutely do that if I had a Blackwing product.
I would find a way to disable the cell modem. I mean, the good thing is on my Volkswagen, I love this. You got rid of yours in time, but I use this as an example all the time, is the difference between a traditional car company and like a modern tech company. My 2019 e-Golf, while it was still under warranty, 2 years into its existence, I think it was Verizon sunsetted all the towers that this 2G modem used, or mm-hmm. 3G, I guess it was. Mm-hmm. And Volkswagen has no
workaround.
They said they were going to make a 4G or 5G modem for it, but it's only for Mexican built cars, not for German built, which is Golf R and e-Golf. I should have a lawsuit. I'm not litigious. I don't believe in the sort of American way frivolously suing people, but I did pay for a car that had certain features. And one of those features was the ability to use my phone to unlock it if I locked my keys in the car, or if I wanted to go to the club and not bring keys with me. So I could use the app on my phone. I could also find the car. I could monitor and
window openness.
I could do that. I could charge it. I could tell it to stop charging. Or what else? Oh, more importantly, I could remotely turn the heat on. And that was a great feature because the car sits outside. It's winter. And I could tell it preheat the cabin using mains power. So I would get in with a full battery and everything was already preheated. It was a great feature. Well, that was sunsetted when the cell towers went down, and I lost that feature. Okay, it's an e-Golf. I'm not all that upset about it. Don't use it, all that. But realistically, that's a ground for a lawsuit, and mm-hmm. somebody else should probably start a lawsuit against Volkswagen on this.
And I'll
happily
you.
Join. I just don't. I can't give a shit. Like I just.
You know, I mean, it's far from the most offensive thing Volkswagen has ever done.
It's far from. I mean. Why'd you have to go there, Dieselgate? But no, I mean, it's far less offensive than this.
We talk about Dieselgate. We now talk about Dieselgate every episode instead of talking about Bruno Sacco every episode.
Why not both?
Okay.
Did Bruno Sacco ever do anything egregious?
No, the technology did not exist, and nor would he have ever done that. He cares about form language and sort of integrating. Okay, we've talked about Bruno Sacco.
No, I'm
and
just
Dieselgate.
I'm Mike, look, we all know companies do really bad things, right? There was this sort of... the Ford Pinto debacle, which was Ford's lawyers.
Yeah, or
lawyers.
Morton Thiokol with the Challenger explosion, right? They knew that there was a problem and they sent the space shuttle up anyway. And those
they
people
did?
Died. Yes. This is one of those engineering ethics things, the same way that, you know, people study the Pinto case, people study the Challenger explosion, because it's one of those the role of ethics in engineering.
Okay, wait a second. All right. So let's back up for a second. I know about the Pinto thing because that was a very clear decision by Ford saying whatever parts they needed to put in to reinforce the gas tank would have cost X amount of dollars. The chance, their prediction was Y amount of people died. It was cheaper to pay off those people than it was to retrofit the cars or to outfit the cars with a reinforcement that would stop them from exploding when rear-ended mm-hmm. and getting rear-ended. What the fuck with the Challenger? Because all I know with Krista McAuliffe, kaboom. That was, I mean, I was young enough. I watched it that mm-hmm. day.
So there was an O-ring that was part of the fuel system. And if the ambient temperature was too low, then it would not seal properly, effectively. And they knew this was a thing. And I think they had scrubbed the launch already once because of ambient temperature issues. And they didn't do it that time. And that's why it happened.
Wow.
Anyway, you study it in engineering ethics contexts. I mean, this is
you did
something
clearly. I didn't.
That one studies it in engineering ethics, but it's a common thing, right? Mm-hmm. There's engineering is always rife with you make calculations about the value of a human life and what kind of safety factor is acceptable. You know, for an airplane wing, it's 150% of the maximum design load is what it must meet in order for it to be certified by the FAA. There's always some, you know, bridges are like this. Everything that gets engineered, people have, there is this overlay of sort of making decisions about either the value of a human life, like is in the Pinto example, or the acceptable failure rate of something. You cannot get it to zero. It's impossible to design something that has a 0% failure rate. So you just decide, you know, and there are conventions that are adhered to that engineers use to say like, okay, this is the safety factor we use when doing this or that or whatever. You know,
it, I guarantee you that that didn't, that it was on the wrong side of the balance on the Challenger.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, clearly no one was going to accept that, that level of risk. And here it is, what, 30 years, 30, how, what year was that? 85 maybe?
38. It was 86. Yeah,
38 years later and we're still talking about it. That's mm-hmm. how much we trust NASA. I mean, this is like United. Can you imagine? Like you fly United.
Or Boeing.
I'm not anymore.
Really?
No. I just had to fly twice with them on a Max and I was shitting bricks the entire time.
If your number's up, your number's up.
No, I'm going to choose a number that's less likely to be up. I mean, I literally, in the break between, before we started recording this episode, I just got another news alert that two more United planes hit each other. I mean, this is hilarious. I'm going to have to put an insert of this, of the United bingo card. So we've had a thing going on lately where I have my friends that fly United and those who are adamant.
Who also fly United. Like the last time we flew anywhere.
Oh, it was miserable. I understand.
Fine. Neither of us died. I have never died while flying United Airlines.
I not only do not want to die on a plane, I don't want to be miserable. And I don't understand why it is. I get in my little Delta fucking seat and the plane just takes off when it's supposed to. And if anything goes wrong, it's like,
attention passengers, this has gone wrong, we have a solution and
we're good. Whereas United, it's like, oh yeah, well, we forgot to put catering on it, and then so we called a backup caterer and it literally got struck by lightning. That was the last one. We flew out of Florida, they're like, the jet bridge got struck by lightning. Why does that only happen to United? Like, it's just become a thing where, like, every 3 days lately, it's some sort of other United fuckery, and then on top you layer the Boeing fuckery on top of that. For years, I made the rule I would never fly on an Airbus plane operated by Air France, because the chance of death on that combo of Airbus plus Air France was like 100x, the next highest combo. And it's because you're French people driving French shit. Forget it. So I would look, and it was like an Air France flight on Boeing. Sure, I take it. It's got to be Boeing times United right now. Like, your chance of arriving on time, zero. Like, no chance. Your chance of, like, your luggage getting there, negative. Like, your luggage is more likely to spontaneously combust in your hand on the way. You seem very offended by this.
No, I'm fine. I'm just going to do whatever I'm going to do. I mean, if I need to get to a place and do a thing, I'm going to do it. It doesn't, I mean.
Really? So you are totally unaffected by this?
Yeah.
The Boeing thing?
Yeah. I mean.
Is it just because actuarially you understand how many flights and what the chances of things actually going wrong?
Yeah, and there's no way to predict it. And like this convenience of I need to go to Zurich, you know, I just came back from Zurich yesterday and I flew United to Munich and then a Boeing product back from Zurich. Like,
was it a Max?
No. They were both 777s. Okay. But you said Boeing generally.
Yeah, no, I'll fly 737. No problem. But
777.
I fly a 3-7. I fly a 747. I love is my favorite plane. But no. The new 3-7 Max. Yeah. That's the problem. No, I'm not getting on one. No chance.
You just did. I watched you do it.
I'm not doing it again. That was after I found out after we booked it. This was my stupidity. This is how nice I am. The United flight.
This is a car podcast.
$1,700 and it was direct. The Delta flight was $2,000 more. It was $3,700 with a stopover. And so I'm like, oh, I hate United. I'll do it. And then I found out afterwards, my boss was like, dude, cancel it and rebook yourself on first class through Delta. Do not get on a United flight. And I'm like, had I known that? But I was trying to be nice to my employer. And also it was more convenient, whatever. But no more Max flights for me. Hmm. I mean, would you do top speed in like, I'm trying to think of like some shitbox car.
Miura?
Yeah. Would you actually go out and do 170 miles an hour in your Miura?
No.
Why?
Why? What's the benefit of doing that? You endanger your life. And your life. I get to the place where I'm trying to go without walking. It's a lot faster than walking or driving. I don't know. Actually, it's just one of those. It's people take. I ride a motorcycle also, right? My risk profile is probably differently shaped than most other people's. If your number's up, your number's up. You know, I'm gonna do whatever I'm gonna do and live without, you know, sort of constraints that prevent me from getting where I'm trying to go. At the time I'm trying to go.
You can't not.
I know everybody's utility function and risk profile is shaped differently. And so some people might listen to sort of this disclosure and they're like, well, I drive like a perfectly civilized person. I don't give a shit anyway, you know? So it depends on the individual. I mean, I find that acceptable because I might be prone periodically to having fun. And, you know, I'd rather not, or, I don't know, or maybe the cost of your insurance premium going up is like, well, okay, it's worth it.
I don't think you're going to find anyone who says, oh, it's worth it. Right?
Well, if you know that I don't know. This kind of calculus happens. Let's say you're having a road rage incident and you're like, I'm going to punt this person off into the median. And then you're like, oh, but then my insurance is going to go up. You don't do it, right? If you're aware and you understand that the causal relationship between taking this action and that outcome, then you like make decisions accordingly and it becomes sort of integrated into your decision-making matrix. But when you get blindsided, and this is the part that's problematic, is the fact that the consumer transparency around this is nil effectively, and that's the purpose of journalism and the Wall Street Journal or whoever the outlet was article that's aimed at raising awareness in the same way that our discussing it here is aimed at raising awareness to consumers that this is a thing.
You're being duped.
Yeah,
your little gamified driver feedback score, yay, is actually going to cost you dearly.
Yeah, or the ability to have an internet connected car, which is now effectively mandatory in all cars, I suppose, has this sort of dark underbelly, and data selling is no new thing. I mean, we do this all the time, and it doesn't seem to offend us when we're doing it as relates to our cell phones, or now you have this mandatory thing: ask app not to track, or the pop up menus that now come with about cookies, especially if you're in Europe, but even in North America, there's bodies, there's entities, people who rail against large government. The government does periodically do stuff like this where they're like, this is an unacceptable thing. People should have the right to know that this is happening. And then you get sort of regulatory change.
I think, if you, in the absence of regulatory change, you're going to wind up with capitalism fixing the problem, right? All of these lawsuits against GM and Honda, whatever, will eventually solve it. What it doesn't do is prevent the problem in the first place from happening in the first place, and also fix the issue for the guy who bought a Corvette, and accelerated because the car was made to accelerate, and then can't get insurance, and then spends $12,000 a year to insure a car because he's deemed some risk without ever having consented to.
Correct. And on some arbitrary basis that may not actually accurately reflect how risky they are. I mean, if you're a professional race car driver and you are operating this car safely, but in a way that it decides is unsafe, that's intrinsically problematic. I have the same problem with speed enforcement, Speed enforcement. Well, I mean, I would argue that, Choose Individual is safer operating at 80 miles an hour than, some jackass is at 47 miles an hour on the same road, even though one of those is safer or more dangerous.
Well, and then factor in one of them is on tires that haven't had their tire pressure checked in 3 years, and three of them are corded, and the other one is neurotic.
And mismatched.
Right.
Yeah. As well. But the fact of the matter is that actuarially, it's impossible to calculate the specific risk profile of each individual. You have to sort of develop some heuristic to stand as a substitute to calculate risk. And there is a correlation between speed and death rates or injury overall. If two people traveling different speeds hit the same object, you are going to have a different outcome based on speed.
Right, but I bet you could find that there's one person who averages 31 miles an hour.
Who's a far greater risk.
Who smashes into everything.
Yes. Just think about old people. They are unsafe drivers, but they also are slow drivers. You have to just sort of develop some, heuristic that sort of approximates reality well enough.
I feel like we've done that over time with insurance actuarial data, right? You are looked at as your sex
demographic
and your age, right? That plus your zip code that establishes
and
you.
The vehicle specifics,
and
of
then
the
vehicle has its own, and there's sort of a calculus that happens. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I, at 18 years old, ordered my Nissan Sentra SER and thought it was going to be so cool driving an SER and realized that my insurance was going to be $380 a month, I couldn't have it. Right. Yeah. That would not be an expensive car for me to insure now.
Right. So this is just the technology enabled evolution of that same type of actuarial.
But it's not predicting accidents. And that primarily, these people didn't sign up for this shit.
Yes.
And no
that's
one.
That's the core issue. Issue is that.
Right. If I knew for sure that those schmucks at OnStar saw everything I'd ever done, even in press cars that I would borrow, I wouldn't get in them. Like, I'm not getting into a GM press car until I know that I can disable this shit. I don't want them to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and whatever. I mean, I've certainly had OnStar call and say, are you okay? Yeah, I'm on a racetrack. That happened literally in filming of the GR Corolla Icons episode, where every time I hit a curb, touched curbing, it called fucking 911. And we actually had to remotely disable the whole system because the sheriff threatened to come and shut us down because he had gotten like 21 calls from the racetrack. We're just filming. Nothing happened. There were no incidents. So, you know, that's a bad enough invasion of my privacy. And a GR Corolla is something I would recommend also. But if now all of a sudden, not only were those false alarms being fed to the sheriff's department, and by the way, it went to the sheriff's department because the system would try to call the car and I didn't have good enough cell service and they couldn't reach the car. So assumed there's been a fatal and then the sheriff is supposed to come out with a helicopter in a city environment, a normal environment. It would have just called me. But if imagine that goes to the insurance company and all of a sudden, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Camisa, it's going to be $12,000 a month for you to insure whatever, because you've hit 7,500 curbs this month. Mm-hmm. You're on a racetrack. Whoa, now we know you're on a racetrack. What are you doing there? I mean, I've had OnStar call and say, you know, we detect heavy braking. Yeah, I'm on a racetrack in a Corvette, you asshole. And by the way, I'm at the Corvette school outside. That happened to me in a 01, like literally at the Corvette experience. What are you doing calling me? And if that was my own car, I'd have been pretty pissed off. Mm-hmm. But the idea that somehow, you know, actuarially, the only thing your insurance company should care about is what your claim record is. Mm. Right? If I drive like you.
Or you.
I can't be self-incriminating here. I work for an insurance company. If I drove like Jake. For example, he's very upset right now. He's also sick. So now he's sick and feigning anger, but I don't think he has the energy to be mad. No, I mean, if I drive like a complete asshole and never hit anything, am I a bigger risk?
Or anyone.
Fair enough. Am I a bigger risk? I don't think so. If the risk is, you know, I am so upset about this. I'm, you know, the fact that I have to remove all of these brands from my shopping list. Like GM makes a lot of great cars. Honda makes a lot of great cars. Subaru makes a lot of great cars, even though we hate the people who drive them. As we keep talking, it's just going to become a running joke. But like Hyundai, Kia, man, all of these car companies other than Mitsubishi.
So the question is, can it be disabled? And, you know,
can you trust them ever again?
Yeah.
How does this happen that some schmuck somewhere in a building somewhere decides that this is a reasonable use of people's personal information? Like, I want to know. As much as there
this
needs
is
to
how
be
the free market works. There's a financial incentive to do this. And so they're like, wow, I could make money by doing this thing that doesn't affect me.
Then there needs to be a financial disincentive to the car companies that's so unbelievably great. It cuts the testicles off of any person you know what I mean? It stops any chance of any attempt at this sort of blatant violation of privacy. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, maybe they're getting 5 cents per record from LexisNexis. They need to be sued almost out of fucking existence over this.
I mean, yeah, this is the purpose of sort of penalties.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to talk about Dieselgate, if they had been fined $100 million for what they did, then they would have been like, nah, that's fine. We, you know, sell billions of dollars of cars a year. It's $100 million worth. It has to be a big enough penalty.
Do you know what the total for Dieselgate is?
Was it like $20 billion or something like that?
It's about to hit 30. Billion in total cost of Volkswagen Group.
Yeah.
Right. And so we've talked about this. We've talked about the Piazzotta episode coming up. I think we could talk about it right now. What really happened with Dieselgate, because it's kind of not really relevant to Piak. Piak was already retired when this happened.
Barely.
So he resigned. 65 years old. He was at mandatory retirement age.
Correct.
So he left
the position of being the chief executive effectively and became the head of head of the management board. Instead.
There are two boards in Germany. There's the supervisory board, which is board of director, and then the board of management with the Vorstand. So he had to leave the Vorstand and went to supervisory board, which means he legally does not have the ability to run the business, but he has legal oversight of the business.
Correct.
That happened in 2002. Mm-hmm. The first defeat device was conceived in, I believe, 04. Mm. So was he still that involved from this point on? I mean,
it depends on your perspective on how operationally involved he was.
I would think fairly.
Exactly. But in 2004. I mean, he didn't leave the supervisory board until 2015.
No, he quit and when Dieselgate erupted.
Before that.
No, it was right afterwards when he distanced him. He said, I'm distancing myself from Martin Winterkorn.
Yeah, yeah.
And the board chose Winterkorn.
Yeah, this happened, though, in like March of 2015.
It was after they already knew about it. So it was 2 months after they knew about it when he said, fuck this, I'm out. And okay, you can, in the episode, you'll see I make him out to be a very big hero. And the reason I felt comfortable doing that is because I didn't see a single thing throughout his entire career where he cheated. He was always, we shouldn't be talking this detail about Piek yet, but he always won with substance.
There were a few dubious sort of ethical things that unfolded at Volkswagen while he was chief executive.
Talk to me.
So there's the whole situation with the guy they hired from GM in Spain.
Lopez.
Yes.
Iggy Lopez. So that, do you know that, right?
Situation,
you know that Ignacio Lopez's daughter was in my homeroom. And one day she disappeared.
Yeah, because
never saw her again.
He disappeared from Volkswagen. Yeah.
They went into hiding. And so, then he was in a very suspicious car accident where somebody just crossed over a double yellow and hit him head on.
Yeah, and left him like debilitated physically.
I think he's still alive. I think he eventually recovered, but yeah. So,
but they claimed when then he went to had his sort of legal recourse from the lawsuits that came out of this industrial espionage thing. That, so he worked for GM.
He was the head of purchasing,
and he was hired away and allegedly allegedly brought a bunch of records and sort of information that was used to sort of develop his relationships and pricing information that GM had with him when he went to Volkswagen. And then, you know, he was sued over this, and I think he eventually received a slap on the wrist, effectively, all said and done years later. So there was this sort of ethical lapse that, you know, Piek was like, nothing happened. It was all fine. You know, no contrition, no admission of wrongdoing.
No admission of wrongdoing. But his point was, this the scariest video. It's included in the icons. The scariest video I've ever seen of anyone ever is Piek giving an interview to the news about the whole Lopez thing. Mm-hmm. And he just kept saying, I don't give a shit about Opel. And the reason it was scary is just his delivery was like, he had eye twitches and half smirks. And it was just scary, genuinely scary. But his point was, I'm not looking towards, like he said, I've made this clear. This is almost a direct quote. I don't have it in front of me, but I've said this before, but I'll repeat myself because you guys obviously haven't been listening. I don't care about Opel. I'm not looking for the number four car company in Europe. I'm looking at the number one in the world. And that was his stance from the get-go. Why the fuck do I care about what Opel was doing? Opel was, you know, nothing compared to what his ambitions
were. Yeah, but what he wants is he wants Lopez because he's so good at purchasing and negotiating rates down, which is exactly what Volkswagen did. Volkswagen had a consistent problem during this era with profitability and productivity. Mm-hmm. I mean, the number of, like, they were making 12 or 15 cars per employee, and Toyota was making 25 cars per employee, and their profit margins were like, you know, 3-5% instead of 10%, mm-hmm. even though they were selling eventually by 2015 or so, they were actually selling more cars than Toyota, but mm-hmm. making much less money. And so their purchasing is a great way to, you know,
save money
mm-hmm. because you're buying stuff at lower prices. So he really needed someone who was an impresario of purchasing. So if there's someone who's known to be really good at this, then you hire them away. And so I think that stance is.
But is that a lapse of judgment on his part to hire his competitor?
No, of course not. Okay. However, when he's bring all that shit with you.
Maybe he didn't say that. I don't know.
He was very good at positioning himself to be insulated in the same way he was with the other scandal that broke under him at Volkswagen, which was the whole prostitution thing.
You're going to have to explain that.
There were all these executives at like Škoda and in Volkswagen for people who would go to this brothel in Prague, I think it was, where they would just use company funds to sort of woo various managers and important executives to make the right decision that favored the outcome of the business. There was also some guy who had a mistress from Brazil who was paid 50,000 euros a year to not do anything. It was just an allowance.
A year or a month?
It was a year. And then, but she also ran up, you know, all in, it was probably 5 million euros of sort of like funds that were used for improper non-company related activities as sort of incentives for various executives in various places. And, you know, Piek's like, I don't know. I don't deal with money. I don't have anything to do with money. This is not my deal. You know, it's not my problem. But he was very good at sort of insulating himself and focusing on product in a way that, you know, all this other stuff. But what he ultimately, you know, you would argue that the chief executive of a company is responsible for sort of the culture in that company. And that culture relates to sort of like morality and sort of decision making. You know, there was this issue with sort of authoritarianism and people being willing, you know, whistleblowing or ability to speak up against authority when they see a problem. And I think this is the fundamental cause of Dieselgate, is that they were like, we have to get these cars out the door and whatever it takes, get it done, you know, and then leaves the room.
I agree. My question is, was that actually Piek or was that Martin Winterkorn?
I mean, they were sort of two sides of the same coin is the way that I've sort of seen them.
I mean, Piek's strategy was make it so, and if you don't like it, get the fuck out. Winterkorn screamed at everyone all the time. Yes. And I was at a dinner where Winterkorn was screaming at people.
Two different personality ways of getting the same outcome.
I think that, so this was really interesting when doing the research for that episode. I never saw a single example where Piek knew or should have known about something and did something that I would consider an egregious violation, right? The prostitutes and whatever, if I think back to just even Mura, right? So when customers came in and brought their Muras in for servicing, Ferruccio Lamborghini would bring them to a dinner that was purposefully elongated with a restaurant that was in the know, that would drag out dinner as long as possible. And they hired hookers to keep the customers distracted while they were chopping up their cars in the background and reinforcing the chassis. Mm-hmm. Do we consider that egregious? I mean, yes, it's clearly not, right? Unethical, but ultimately this was just a ruse to get what they wanted, right? Shut the customer up. You know, let them leave us alone and we're going to fix a problem. We're going
to
bury it.
To be fair, Lamborghini owned the company at the time, you know, and so it's not a violation of your fiduciary duty to shareholders when you're spending money in this way. You could spend the money on whatever you want if you own the company. When it's a publicly held company like Volkswagen, where you have this duty to the public and, you know, and then there's pensions that own shares and municipalities and sort of it's a public concern as opposed to Lamborghini where it's just some rich guy's plaything. I think that's worth noting there.
Yeah, that's.
I think there was a culture at Volkswagen that, you know, didn't inspire oversight and didn't give enough internal control, which is why the Dieselgate thing was allowed to sort of perpetuate to the extent
Clearly. I just think it happened
especially
after
the concealing thing.
I think it happened after him. I wouldn't be surprised. So I met Winterkorn once. Let's be very clear about this. Martin Winterkorn is now a fugitive of the U.S. He cannot step foot in this country. He'll go straight to prison. Mm-hmm. He's about to stand trial in Germany, finally for the Dieselgate thing. It has been proven multiple times in multiple different ways that he was well aware of the emissions cheat devices. It's also really, I think, important to point out that in Europe, these cheat devices were not considered cheat devices. There was,
and the enforcement reflects that. You know, no one was doing it.
No one was doing it, but also there were exemptions written directly into the law that says very ambiguously and very vaguely for the protection of the engine, you can change the injection strategy and stuff like that.
It was the protection of the engine was a key part of it.
Right. And so for example, at 20 degrees Celsius or below, Chrysler, for example, was found to have changed completely the injection strategy in all of their diesels. Well, you don't need to protect them at 19 degrees Celsius at 66 degrees Fahrenheit, right? You need to protect them at minus 10. But they did it because the test happened at 22 or 20 and 22. And so they just changed it. And there was no, they were saying, oh, yeah, we're protecting the engine. And it wasn't actually a big deal. I think at the very beginning of this whole Dieselgate thing, which how the whole thing started is unbelievable, right? It was by chance that a European group contracted an American West Virginia university to say, hey, listen, we'd like to have clean diesels here in Europe too. And Volkswagen in the US is making clean diesels. Mm-hmm. And everyone is saying this is not possible. We'd like to study how Volkswagen is doing this so we can use that as a textbook to show all the other companies in Europe that, hey, we deserve clean air too, and this is how you do it. And they were trying to help and inadvertently
discovered that Volkswagen, cars were in the real world performing extremely differently than they were in the tests.
Yeah, it was the opposite of a witch hunt. It was like, hey, look at this. They're doing amazing things. Let's just figure out what they're doing to help everyone else. Mm-hmm. But I really don't think anyone at Volkswagen appreciated just how big of a violation it was in the US because it wasn't in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, there were people in the meeting where this was sort of put forth for the first time, where people expressed apprehension and discomfort with the idea, the engineers at Volkswagen.
Well, and it was James Liang, who is actually a German but working in California, and he's the one that wrote the cheat code initially and said, whoa, this is not legal, but he did it anyway. That was after PX was
gone. Is representative of the company culture that existed.
Yeah. But I didn't see, so the prostitutes are one thing, you know, the sort of mistresses and whatever else, you kind of see that all through all different companies, right? Ahead of Ernst Lieb was the head of Mercedes-Benz North America for many, many years. And so when I was at Automobile, he was the figure for many, many years. And he wound up getting ousted because he had a company apartment that was not legit, basically. He was funneling a ton of money into this company apartment and doing renovations on it. Mm-hmm. That was basically his personal apartment that Mercedes-Benz North America was coming up, was paying for. And what was told to me at the time was German executives don't make anything close, European executives don't make anything close to what they make in the US. Mm-hmm. Like our compensation packages are just outrageous. And so there was a cap on executive pay at Mercedes-Benz, but they realized that was not competitive in the US. Mm-hmm. And so the deal that they struck with him, this is what I was told, was that he would get the max under the German cap, but they would have to sort of backdoor in a whole bunch of other ways. So he had these budgets that at his discretion could build an apartment and do whatever else. This was the way of getting around their own internal limitations, which would have rendered Mercedes-Benz completely uncompetitive in the US, right? They would have never had a good present. Well, there was a problem when somebody from the stock exchange came around and started looking at books and then was looking at everything, and they uncovered this and boom, had to fire him. Did he do anything wrong? I mean, that's my question. Did he do anything wrong? Because I don't think he did. Mm-hmm. That was part of an agreed compensation package that was getting around a poorly written company rule. And I don't hold that against him, right? Mm-hmm. Sure. Great. If the company thinks you're worth $2 million a year and your cap is $500,000, fine. Find another way to get that extra $1.5 million out of the company. If you guys both agree on it, then it's fair to everyone. Maybe not the shareholders who would think that they would be complying to that. But hey, that's not that I kind of don't judge anyone for doing that. I sort of feel the mistresses and the prostitutes and whatever. Do I think it's good business practice? Of course not. But I think it was kind of done lot.
Yes.
I mean, I heard stories of journalists getting hookers and blow in the 80s on car launches. My only problem with that is it stopped before I got in this business. Like, fuck that. I never got any of that good stuff. Not that I would have partaken in any anyway, but the point is, I never saw egregious cheating under Ferdinand Piëch. Mm-hmm. And I never saw something like this where, you know, companies are acting in that obviously disingenuous way to make a cent at the expense of people. I think Piëch was the reason I'm willing to hold him up as a hero in that video is because I never saw an example of it. Anything that he touted as a benefit, it was, and there was engineering behind it. It wasn't marketing. It was substance.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say one of the recurring themes with him is that machines were the most important to him. People were of secondary importance to machines. And he was a person who was motivated by machinery and, you know, like his... You bring this up in the episode about how stock price was immaterial to him, and it was one of the, you know, obviously the board is not super keen on the way that the stock price has languished, especially because then that allowed Volkswagen to become a takeover target because the stock was so cheap that someone could hypothetically or actually afford to buy enough of the stock to try to exercise a takeover, which is what exactly what happened with Porsche in 2008.
Yeah, so what you're talking about was Porsche, which was the David in this David and Goliath, much a fraction the size of Volkswagen, came within hours basically of buying Volkswagen.
A majority share, which is 75%.
By kind of manipulating the stock market and taking advantage of Volkswagen's depressed stock price, which was depressed because Piëch refused to give quarterly reports.
He didn't care about money. He was just focused on product. And he would do things that were sort of expensive and maybe pointless from a stockholder standpoint, like buying Bugatti and then building Veyrons and causing Volkswagen to lose, you know, hundreds of thousands of euros per car that they built, you know. And so the stock price reflected that. Of course, the flip side of that coin is that the Piëch family, you know, who is the grandson of Ferdinand Porsche, you know, they have perhaps an interest in the Porsche company doing well and taking, you know, over all of this stuff.
he would have wound up, had the Porsche takeover
succeeded,
he would have actually lost out. So the way the whole structure worked, and that chapter I read twice in this one book because I couldn't, it's so difficult to follow.
Yeah, it's very much about like sort of puts and shorts and synthetic shares.
I mean, Margot Robbie in a bathtub is not enough to explain to me what a short is. But the long and short of it was he wound up with far more interest in, well, he wound up with control over Porsche, which yes. He wouldn't have otherwise gotten, which is ironic because that's the one company he hadn't worked for since he was 20s.
Yeah.
In his 20s.
Yep. Although his mother owned a substantial interest in Porsche.
Well, and he actually was part of the group that put in Wendell and Wiedeking. Mm-hmm. So he's responsible. So, we'll talk about this in the episode, but the list of companies that he saved from bankruptcy, or so he saved Volkswagen from bankruptcy and then almost.
And had previously done that at Audi.
Right. And then did it at Porsche.
Correct.
When Porsche almost went bankrupt and also saved Lamborghini from bankruptcy and bought Bugatti out of bankruptcy. It's unbelievable.
Bentley also.
But we're not talking about Ferdinand Piëch.
Yeah, now we just did. I mean, these are things that I presume are too sort of in-depth for us to discuss
in that. Well, the Piëch episode of Icons is going to be like 7 episodes long, which I guess it just started here. But the point is corporate. I think, this whole thing, corporate conscience.
No incentive, right? The businesses like this respond to two things, consumers and regulators, effectively. Right. So in the absence of forces that cause these companies to behave in a way that has the, I don't know what we call it, ethically, mm-hmm. I guess, then they're going to do fuckery like this.
Yeah.
And so it's up to consumers and regulators to sort of call it out and identify it.
Yeah. And I'm glad this got exposed. Mm-hmm. I can no longer recommend a Honda Civic Type R. I can no longer recommend any of the Blackwing cars. I mean, GM made a statement that they're severing arrangements with LexisNexis, but
they're going to send it to some other company called Texas Brexis or whatever, and it's going to do exactly the same damn thing and give it to insurance companies.
Nexis. such a shame.
Yeah. It is a complete violation of trust, which is not atypical. Here we are.
As annoying as European data protection rules are, and they are really, really tight, mm-hmm. this is why they exist.
Yes.
I don't think this would fly in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Air quality, on the other hand, fuck that.
Fuck them. Hey, last year, Europeans bought more electric cars than they bought diesels. So
really?
Dieselgate.
See if that's a trend or it actually sticks, because I know that there's this. Yeah, the regulations are sort of mandating it.
Yep.
Well, that was an uplifting and somewhat meandering episode of the Carmudgeon Show.
You know what? If you're the type of person who's in charge of making a cent off of buying people's information and ruining their lives,
I hope you die.
You heard it here first.
That's what you were going to say, right?
I wasn't going to. I mean.
Well, that was very efficient.
Yes, join us next week. Next week, our episode is going to be a day late and
probably $1 short, which is remarkable given that you pay zero for this content, dear reader.
They're not readers. You chastise me for that, about calling them readers a couple episodes. They're listeners. It's going to be a day later.
I guess people do say dear listener. Do they say dear listener, or do you only say dear reader?
Dear listener. They're not going to say dear reader on a radio show.
Yes.
Podcast. Okay. We'll be back on the 23rd because, assuming nothing else changes, because there is an embargo on a new car that I've driven, and I think you guys should know about it. And Derek hasn't, so he gets to quiz me and then get all curmudgeon.
Is it bigger than a bread box?
Yes. Meaning like a Z3M coupe?
Is that a clown shoe? That's a clown shoe, but it's also a bread van. Not a bread. I said bread box, not a bread van.
Wonder Bread or like some bougie?
Baguettes. Just baguettes.
Bye. See you next week.